Last night I talked about the second noble truth, the samudaya, the origin of suffering, of dukkha samudaya, the three kinds of desire, kama dhanha, pava dhanha, vipava dhanha, and the desire, the attachment we have to the body, the emotions, the material world, to thoughts, views, opinions, wanting things that we don't have, not wanting what we have. Well, this we can definitely begin to reflect on in our own mind, because these are very much from our own human experience. Desire is to be laid aside, to be let go of. And as I gave the example of the clock, laying aside means putting down or letting go, but not throwing away. So in your practice, hopefully today, you begin to maybe even deliberately pick up things in order to practice letting go of them. For example, I want a piece of cake. One deliberately picks up something in order to let it go. So you become aware of this laying aside, letting things go. If you think, I want a piece of cake, is something that you've got to pursue any further, you attach to that view, to that thought, and of course it will condition another thought, and possibly an action, or some speech, or whatever. But when you just see it as it is, it's a condition that arises and ceases. And this awareness of the space around a thought, I'm pointing this as a skill, pointing out this is a skillful means. Whatever you think you are, you can think that, but deliberately think it to note the space around it. Now it's true, isn't it, when you really, if you contemplate your own life, that you're not always thinking, but you're not aware when you're not thinking. We're so identified, say modern human beings, are so identified with their thoughts. When you're not thinking, then you're like when you're, why do we like sports? Or do kind of dangerous things, or things that completely absorb our attention. Like if you're playing a sport, playing basketball or something, you can't really think. You have to be alert, pay attention to what's going on. If you start thinking about yourself while playing basketball, you can't pay attention to what's going on. So that you're missing out. You're the one that people yell at and they call away because you're a useless player. As you start becoming self-conscious, thinking about yourself, the more you lose yourself in attentiveness to where the ball is and what's going on, then of course that's an exhilarating kind of feeling, to not be a person anymore, isn't it? To be just what is happening, say in an exciting game, competitive game. Oneself doesn't exist in those moments of concentration. Then if you make one of the scores, then the self, look what I've done, see what a good basketball player I am. Then the self comes in at that moment, if you're an unenlightened basketball player. Climbing mountains, the story I like to tell about when we were in Switzerland several years ago, is with Tita Panya, who was an anagarika then. And the lady took us to the Schilthorn, which is a revolving restaurant on top of a mountain. You have to take all these different kind of train, rail cars up this mountain in a lift, and you go up to the top, on top of a mountain, Swiss mountain, and you're sitting in this restaurant drinking tea on top of a mountain in Switzerland, amazingly. And this restaurant revolves very slowly. So it goes around, and you sit there drinking tea, and birds are swooping around into the crags on the mountain peak. there's a clanky elevator nearby. You think you're out on top of a Swiss mountain, it'll be nice, peaceful stillness, but it's really this clanky elevator. That's another thing to complain about. And then we were looking, and right across from us, out the window, was the Eiger, the famous mountain, the northern face of the Eiger, which is famous for people, daring people trying to climb this northern, it's the sheer face of the mountain. And it's extremely dangerous. And they were telling me that people come up and sit in this restaurant during the mountain climbing season to watch people fall off this mountain, which is a sure death. There's nothing going to, you're not going to fall in anything but rocks. So I was talking to Tita Panya. I said, why do people want to do that? Because he used to be a mountain climber. I said, why do people, when they know how dangerous it is, why do they want to do such a thing and climb, take the risk of losing your life over something so terribly unimportant and useless as climbing the northern face of the Eiger? And he said, because, he said, when you're doing that, you're really concentrated. When your life's in danger, your mind is completely with what you're doing. And that's a very kind of blissful experience. To be completely, your mind is not being distracted by anything, but completely with each movement of your body. And you know that if any, and the imminent death is so apparent to you that there's no possibility of your mind wandering anywhere else. I can understand that, you know, that because that is a blissful state, to be completely one with something, with what you're doing, where the suffering that we have, say, in our lives of security and affluence and that, always is in the fact that everything's so safe and convenient that the mind can go any which way. It goes all over the place until something really urgent happens where we have to compose it and hold it on to something. But so much of our life now is kind of guaranteed securities, isn't it, in a country like this, where you can go on the dole, you can always get something, you can survive without putting forth much effort at all. In Britain, you somehow can survive and even have a certain amount of luxury you can depend on without really putting any kind of effort into your life. And so there's a lot of mental anguish and neurotic problems of people because they have no chance to ever experience that freedom of not being, except they do it in things like going to films or taking drugs where that can kind of fade out. But then that is something that is unskillful. One becomes addicted or lost, wandering from this to that. Just following the desires. Desire for pleasure, desire for emotional security, desire to become something, desire to get rid of something. Just lost, bound by these three kinds of desires. Now there are moments if you're playing a musical instrument. To really play like a violin well, you have to concentrate your mind on what you're doing, and in that concentrated state there's no self either. There's no sense of me and mine. After you've done it, or you make a mistake or something, then the self arises. Oh, I made a mistake. But actually if you're a skilled musician, you become just one with what you're doing, and the sense of self-consciousness, me and mine, is gone at that moment. So there's this desire to absorb into things, do things that are absorbing our attention, either do it skillfully, like with music or art or dance or something where we can really completely absorb our attention, all our energies into one particular type of activity where we lose ourselves. But then oftentimes these just create an ego, because when we're not actually absorbed into what we're doing, then we start thinking, then we make judgments about whether what we're doing is good or bad, or whether people like it or don't like it, whether it's worthwhile or not, whether we're really talented or not, whether we're the greatest of the century or not, or just a mediocre failure. Then the self always comes in afterwards. But even if you notice, when you're really concentrated on something, there's no self. When you're really concentrated on the breath, on the inhalation, there's no self in that. There's no sense of being anybody, of being a person. That sense is gone. That's something that comes after you think, did I do that properly, or whether you the self is then created afterward, after you're not concentrated. But concentrating, like samatha practices, are there's no self in it, in the moment of concentration, even though one might be doing it for egotistical purposes. You know, I'm practicing samatha meditation to be the first European to ever attain the fourth jhana, something like this. Now, this is a very kind of egotistical reason to do it, but actually while you're absorbed, there's no self. But because there's no wisdom, there may not be any wisdom along with that, then of course it becomes a selfish attachment. When you go to the cinema and you're really, there's a good film on and you're really absorbed into that, there's no self anymore, isn't it? You're completely absorbed into the lives of those beings, those shadowy beings on the screen. So you're the sense of me and mine, my as a separate personality is gone at that moment, while you are absorbed into the drama, the story that's going on the screen. The people watch television, they're absorbing all the time into things, because the sense of self is a painful one. It always brings suffering into the moment. So you're in the most beautiful situation, the most wonderful people. There's nobody to blame, you know, everything is just fine, but this sense of self can creep in. And you can be absolutely miserable when there's no reason to be, other than you've created some kind of person onto the scene. You've painted yourself onto the canvas. Our society is very much a society where we distract ourselves. We like to absorb into things. We don't like to be anybody, actually. It's too painful to always be somebody, so that these desires take us over. We go into becoming things, trying to become something. We can become something for a while, something else for a while, can't we? Become the mountain climber, become the artist, become the person on the cinema screen, become this, become that for a while, but then we're always left back with ourselves, this feeling of alienation, of dukkha. When we're say in love with somebody, the sense of we lose ourselves, we feel a sense of giving up ourselves. The self is no longer there for a moment when we give ourselves to somebody else, and so that's an exhilarating feeling, to not be anybody, but to be absorbed into someone else. But then the suffering comes when we're always demanding we become somebody too. You say we attach, we want to hold on to the person or identify and create a problem about the whole thing. So in romance, of course, there's always, if you listen to popular rock music, it's all the wails. To me it sounds like a continuous wailing about having lost somebody. It's an anguished cry. All the futile attempts and union and fulfillment and oneness, and they all lead to separated from my baby. My baby don't love me no more. With the reflection on the noble truths, of course, we're bringing into consciousness this very problem, this human existence, this sense of alienation, this blind attachment to the sensory consciousness, to that which is separate and exists or stands forth. Where our identity, out of ignorance and not understanding things as they are, we identify with what exists or stands forth in consciousness. In other words, what is mortal, what is death-bound, what is unsatisfactory. And because of that blind attachment, a very attachment is dukkha, is suffering. And we attach out of ignorance by attaching to desires, for sense pleasures. Now, sense pleasures are all mortal pleasures. There's nothing in the sense realm that has any immortal, that is immortal in any way. It's all mortal, it's all death-bound. So whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, or feel, is mortal, it's death-bound, in other words. Mortal means bounded by death. And so death is what we attach to when we're out of Gama Dhanha. We're attaching to what is dying, what dies. And we're demanding that it not. We haven't contemplated it. We haven't understood it. So we're blindly attaching. Out of ignorance, we attach to death, mortality, hoping that it won't be that way, that we can, just by ignoring that aspect of it, that we can stave it off for a while, pretend that no longer, that we're going to be really happy with the things we're attached to, only to feel eventually disillusioned, despairing, disappointed. Whatever we want to become, the becoming, we might succeed in becoming what we want, but then that also is mortal. Death, we're attaching to a death-bound condition again. And then there's the desire to die. So we attach to maybe suicide or to annihilation, attaching to another death-bound condition, death itself. So whatever we attach to, in these three kinds of desires, we're attaching to death, which means that death is going to be we're going to experience a sense of death or disappointment or despair. Like death of the body, but death of the mind is despair, isn't it? Depression is when it's a kind of death, death experience of the mind. Depression and despair and anguish and all these death, mental states, dying. Just like the body dies, physical death, the mind dies, the mental state, mental conditions die, but we call it despair, boredom, depression, anguish, and all that. So whenever we attack, whenever that those conditions, we're experiencing boredom, despair, anguish and sorrow, then we tend to seek rebirth again in something. We look for some other mortal condition that's rising up. So you're feeling despair. I want a piece of chocolate cake. Off you go. For a moment, you can absorb into the sweet, delicious, chocolatey, rich chocolatey flavor of that piece of cake. And at that moment, there's becoming, isn't it? You've become the sweet, delicious, chocolatey flavor for a moment. Now that's in your consciousness. So you've become sweet, chocolatey, and rich. Only what? You can't hold on to that very long when you swallow it and what's left. So then you have to go and do something else. So this is becoming, this becoming process on the sensual plane is what we're involved in, what we're caught into and blinded by. So by knowing these three kinds of desires as they are, not judging, we're not diminishing the importance or the beauty or anything else of the sensual plane, or exaggerating its negative side, we're pointing to it. In whatever quality it might be in, whether it's magnificent or mean, beautiful or ugly, it's just this way. We see it as it is, there's the knowing. And by laying aside, not grasping at desire, then we experience nirodha, or the cessation of suffering. Now the cessation is the third noble truth, nirodha means cessation, and then we must realize this sensation. We must realize cessation. So when we contemplate cessation, we say there is cessation. We know when something is ceased. Now, how do you know when something ceases? You have to let it cease. You have to lay desire aside, allow it to be, let it go, allow it to go. And what's left, when it's gone, when it has ceased, then you realize nirodha, or cessation, emptiness, non-attachment. So nirodha is also another word for nibbana, non-attachment. When you have let something go, you have allowed something to cease and end, what's left is peace. That state you feel in, that which you feel when something has ceased and you're not looking for another rebirth, is the peace of nirodha or nibbana. Now in Thailand, when we chant at funerals, when anyone dies, like in a village in northeast Thailand, they invite the monks and you chant. And you chant a little Pali chant, goes Anicca Vadasangara Ubhantavaya Tamino Ubhachitavani Ruchanti Desang Ubhasamo Sukho, which means Anicca Vadasangara, all conditioned phenomena, all mortal conditions are impermanent, anicca. They arise and they cease, and in their ceasing is peace. So cessation, this is a reflection at when somebody has died. In their ceasing is peace. So in the cessation of a condition, there's peace, but it's not annihilation, is it? Now you can experience that peace through your own meditation. That which is left over when you've let desire end and cease in your mind, that's very peaceful, that's true peacefulness. It's deathless peacefulness. So that when you know that, when you really know that as it is, you realize nirodha satya, then you know what's going to happen when your body dies. Peace. Because that's all, the body just dies, it goes like a thought. And then what's left is peace. It's not annihilation, is it? When you realize that nirodha, the truth of nirodha, there's no self. But there's still alertness, there's still clarity, And that is a very, that's what the really meaning of bliss is that peaceful, deathless, transcendent consciousness. Now this is to be realized in, and this is what the Buddha was, his most emphatic statement was, this is a truth to be realized now, here and now. I don't have to wait to find out whether Buddhism is true, to find out whether it's all true when you die. You may be taking a risk, you know, maybe we're going the wrong way, you know, and we'll only know when we die whether it's Jesus or Buddha. But for the truths, the four noble truths, these are to be realized, you know, before we die. There's no point in waiting to die, because the teaching itself is for living human beings like ourselves. But you're learning the truth from the way it is your experience, from your own direct experience. There's no way I can tell you about Nirodha and make you believe it and experience it. And I can tell you about it, I can encourage you to do it, but I can't make you realize it. Go up to you and shake and say, can't you realize the truth of cessation? And shake you up. Sometimes I feel like doing that. But there's no way you can make somebody realize something that each one of us has to realize. So the same applies. Cessation, Nirodha, there is Nirodha, there is cessation of suffering. Cessation should be realized. And then by practicing, contemplating, cessation, we realize cessation. Cessation has been realized. Cessation is realized. Now don't think this is something beyond your ability, or see it as something remote. It's always, when we talk about Dhamma or truth, we're talking about Santitiko, Akaliko, Ehipatsuko, Upanayako, Bhajitang, Reti, Dapo, Vinuhi. Which means here and now, to be seen for ourselves. Turn to that. Turn, open yourself up. Incline toward that, toward the truth. What we incline is we pay attention to the way it is now. Here and now, at this time, at this place, the way is through mindfulness, isn't it? So we are alert. We bring attention to the way it is. We can use sampachanya. We say the Pali word sampachanya. They use sati and sampachanya. Awareness of self. All this view of self, this self-view of me and mine, my body, my feelings, my memories, my thoughts, my views, my opinions, my house, my car, or you and yours, and all this, we're aware of these. We bring, through mindfulness, we investigate this sense of self. Let's really listen to this sense of self, like the I am. I am Sumedho. Listen to that. This I arises out of what? Am Sumedho. And where does that, what happens to it? When I think of myself in emotional terms, I think I'm really, my tendency was self-disparagement. I'd always think of myself in negative terms. No good. But where does that arise out of and cease? Or say, I'm really better than you. I'm more highly attained. I'm I've been living the holy life for a long time, so I'm better than any of you. Where does that arise and cease? So in arrogance, conceit, or self-disparagement, or whatever it is, you examine it. Listen to it, like the inner listening. I am. And you note the space that arises. Be aware, be attentive to before you're thinking it, and then think it, and then after you've thought it. And sustain your attention on that emptiness of, at the end of that, I am. See how long you can hold your attention to that. See if you can hear the kind of sound of silence, or the primordial sound, the ringing, a kind of ringing sound in the mind. Concentrate your attention on that, so you're, and in that state you can reflect, is there any sense of self? When you're really empty like that, when there's no object, but there's just clarity, alertness, attention, there's no self. There's no sense of me and mine. So I practice, I sit like this, and I go to that empty state. And I contemplate Dhamma. I think this is just as it is. This body here is just this way. I can give it a name or not according to whether it's what I want to communicate, can't I? But right now, say, in empty state, in empty mind, it's just this way. It's not tomato. That's something you use to communicate something else to, or it can be just an obsession. If I'm thinking about myself out of ignorance and stupidity, then I am tomato, and goes on like that. But in emptiness, there's no concept, and there's no self right now. But then if you ask, what is your name? I say, Sumedho Bhikkhu. Can be an appropriate response to time and place. But it's not an obsession, not a delusion anymore. A Buddhist monk. I'm a Buddhist monk, and I live the holy life, blah, 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 blah. And then somebody says, down with all Buddhist monks, bunch of skinheads. How dare they talk to me like that? Do you realize I've been a monk for 18 years and been leading a life of celibacy and don't have any money and not done any evil things, and they call me a skinhead? Then there's a sense of, there's an emotional response of, because the idea of the self has been touched. I am a Buddhist monk. And then if you criticize, condemn, or make fun of Buddhist monks, then I get very angry. But if there's emptiness, you say, down with all Buddhist monks, they're a rotten bunch of skinheads. Nothing. And no Buddhist monk. What some people call this is up to them, isn't it? They call it a skinhead or a Hare Krishna or whatever. That's their problem, not mine. At least I won't make a problem. Because abiding in emptiness, there's no Buddhist monk. But then, if you ask me, what are you? And you know, and I know that you're curious about what order I belong to. I say I'm a Buddhist monk. A sense of conventional communication. So in emptiness, we find this space all the time to deal with life as it happens. Because if we don't have that space, then our life is a mere reaction. Praise, somebody says, Buddhist monks are the most wonderful people. I've always wanted to meet a Buddhist monk, and I've heard so much about you, Venerable Sumedho. I hear you're such a wonderful, highly attained, saintly being. wonderful? It's really nice, that woman. very sensitive. She's a very sensitive kind of person. Then somebody else comes along and says, I says, what are you? And I'm a Buddhist monk. Buddhist monks? Rotten bunch of skinheads. Off, they should let them all burn themselves up like they did in Vietnam. Why don't you go and set yourself on fire and get rid of them? Then I dare you, you know, get angry. So there is a Buddhist monk that is ignorant and gets elated over praise and gets angry over criticism. But in emptiness, there's no Buddhist monk. It's merely a convention appropriate to time and place. So when people praise, they say, absolutely wonderful, you know, that's just somebody praising, saying something pleasant. How sincere or how true it is not something you're taking personally, because there's no Buddhist monk there. There's just this is the way it is. It's just the suchness. It's just this way. As soon as I attach to the idea of being a Buddhist monk, then I am caught in the praise and blame. People praise me, I feel good, and people blame me, I feel depressed. If things are going well, you know, everything is, things aren't going so well. If I want everything to work well, to go well, go smoothly, I want Amravati to be a successful place. I want people to say, Amravati is a marvelous place, it's a great success. I want it to be truly successful. And then it would say, everybody says, and it is successful, it is a great success, and I'm happy. Or if it all failed, nobody's interested and can't pay the electricity bill and everything falls apart, failure. So there's a success, you go up, the success, isn't it? We like success, and then there's failure. But when you don't see that anymore, there's no Amaravati, it's just this way. Right now it's this way. And whatever way it is the way it's supposed to be. And so whether it succeeds or doesn't succeed or fails is something that is appropriate to time and place, but no longer is one being attached to that. One doesn't carry the burden of such a place on one's shoulders, because we see it as it really is. It's not a personal, there's no personal to be involved in it. It's only a conventional place, it's not an ultimate reality. So whether it succeeds or fails, we realize is up to many other things. It's no longer something that one need make into a personal burden or make into a personal problem. So in emptiness, things are just what they are, and there's things can be as they are. We can, when we see, when we're aware in this way, it doesn't mean we're indifferent and don't care. We just think success or failure, it doesn't matter, so we don't bother to do anything. That's not it. But we know what we can do. We can apply ourselves, these conditions, these five aggregates, to what has to be done in the right way. So that what we do may look like personal, like it's a person doing it, but it's not, it's Dhamma. Everything becomes the Dhamma, the way it is. So we apply our energies, not out of a sense of personal, of a personality, or gaining, or achieving, or attaining, or out of fear of failure, but because that is the right thing to be doing at this time and this place. Or we refrain from doing certain things because it's the time not to do certain things. This is what we know from emptiness, from seeing things through an empty mind rather than through a fixed view or an ideal or an assumption. In this, in our refuge in Sangha now, when we take Sankhang Saranangachami, we in Sangha, there's this sense of one Sangha, you see, rather than a group of individual beings. Like when we're now contemplating Dhamma, we're using Buddha wisdom, the teachings of Buddha, to contemplate the way things are. And what's left is Sangha, the virtuous one, that which is doing good, refraining from doing evil. And it's one thing rather than a group of individual personalities, different characters and all that. The sense of being an individual person, a man or woman or a character or whatever, is no longer what we're grasping at. It's no longer me and mine. So that the Sangha, the sense of Sangha is realized as a refuge. This one, it's a oneness, it's a community, it's a group. Sangha is always a group. It means more than one person. So it can mean just a collection of fascinating individual personalities, but this isn't the sense of the Sangha that we're taking refuge in. It's that unity of being awake and alert, no longer attached, even though the manifestations are all individual. Our realization is the same. We realize cessation. We abide in emptiness. In emptiness is where we all merge. There's no person in emptiness. People arise and cease in emptiness. But when there's emptiness, then there's no person. There's just clarity, awareness, peacefulness, purity. So now, during this evening, begin to really note that in yourself. Really work with the mind so that you're following. I am listening to it, listening beyond it. Begin to sustain your attention on no thought, on emptiness, so that you are aware of emptiness, the empty mind. It becomes very, you know the empty mind, rather than thinking that the empty mind is something you have to get and find later. You're actually being aware that it's nothing more than when thought has ceased or before it has begun. If you're attentive, you have to be alert. Because when we're not alert, we tend to sink into thoughts and worries and doubts or dullness, and the hindrances take over. So to be alert, you transcend the hindrances. So see it as a kind of inner listening, attentive listening, and you're using, say, I am, not as a condition to believe in or attach to, but as a means to listen. So you're listening to it, listening between I and am, listening before I, listening after am, sustaining that attentiveness, that sustaining your attention. See how long you can sustain your attention and just be alert.